We are continuing our journey through the life of Jesus, and today we have a bit of an unusual story that Jesus told. Now, when I say unusual, I mean, Jesus did a lot of unusual things, I think, for his time. People felt that way. But the reason I say unusual is because if you've read your Bible through the years, you've read this story. And if you've been in church long enough, you've probably heard, it's probably come up somewhere. But you know, probably not very many of us have heard very much teaching or messages from this story directly. So it may not be as front and center if you're even much aware of it at all. But I want us to look at it today because I think it teaches a great lesson. We'll see probably the reason why it's sometimes not getting the focus of some more obvious ones to other people. But we're going to see a great truth, and we'll address all that together today. The story is found in Luke 16. Luke 16, we're going to begin with verse 1. It says, Jesus told this story to his disciples. Now, I want to point that out first, because Jesus talked to different crowds, and sometimes it's helpful to know what crowd he's speaking to. Sometimes when Jesus spoke, he spoke to multitudes outdoors, like on the side of a mountain or next to a lake. Sometimes he spoke to a house full of people. Sometimes it was religious people. Sometimes it was a mixed crowd with a lot of irreligious people. Sometimes it was to a one-on-one, to a woman by the well, or to a religious leader like Nicodemus at night. And sometimes it was to his own disciples. And as Jesus would talk to different groups, it's helpful sometimes contextually to know who he's speaking with. And it says, Jesus told this story to his disciples. He said this, there was a certain rich man who had a manager handling his affairs. Now, how nice to be rich enough to have people who handle all of your affairs. How many of you would like that? How many of you have that? Oh, don't raise your hands. That'd be great, you know. They just do your laundry, cook all your meals, clean all your stuff, do all your yard keeping. You're like, I do have that. It's my spouse. Okay, but That's not what's going on here. This is a rich person. This is a rich person who has money to pay people. And this man in the story is a manager, sort of like Joseph was in the Old Testament when he managed Potiphar's affairs. And so this manager, he is not like he's a financial manager, as we're going to see in a lot of ways. He handles money, but he's not like an investment portfolio specialist or a, whatever. You might have someone next town over that handles, you know, a retirement account for you or something, and they have dozens, if not hundreds of clients. This manager works for one man. You know, you're rich when you have one exclusive money manager just for your money and for all his other affairs. This guy works only for this rich man. That's his whole job. And he handles this rich man's affairs. It says in the next part of the verse that one day, a report came that the manager was wasting his employer's money. And you know how you feel when you get a notification that says maybe you're getting ripped off? You think you got scammed or hacked or a fraudulent bank charge went through or something else went wrong. The minute you think that happened, there's a knot in your stomach, like what happened? And this is just a report. It might not even be true at this point. But the manager has heard that rich man has heard that this manager is wasting his money. I imagine that instantly there's a knot in his stomach as well. It says in the next verse, so the employer called him in and he said, what is this I hear about you? Get your report in order because you're going to be fired. Now he doesn't fire him yet. He doesn't fire him in the moment. He says, I'm going to give you a chance to show me the books. But if you can't show me that the report's wrong and you can't show me clean books, then you're going to be fired. So get ready. Verse 3, it says, the manager thought to himself, now what? My boss has fired me. Well, that tells you he's guilty right there because he isn't even fired yet. He actually still works for the boss until the next meeting. But he's like, I'm as good as fired because I know that when I sit down with that guy and I show him the books, there is no answer. He's going to see I've been wasting his money. I'm fired. I'm going to be fired when we get together. Now what am I supposed to do? He goes on and says this. He says, I don't have the strength to dig ditches, and I'm too proud to beg. I don't know if he didn't work out to the gym often, and he was kind of puny or is older. But either way, he's like, manual labor, not for me. Begging, not for me. I've been a money manager for a rich man. It's a great resume. If I lose this job, what am I going to do? I'm not going to get a good reference. What's going to happen to me? Now what? And then in verse 4, he says, ah, I know how to ensure that I'll have plenty of friends who will give me a home when I am fired. Notice when, again, I'm going to get fired. I know that. But I know how to ensure I have people to look out for me, to give me a home. Because isn't that what we all need? We all need to eat and live indoors. He's like, I know how to have people who will help take care of me when this job is about to end after my next meeting with the boss. I know what to do. You notice he's thinking about friends, people who will look out for him. We'll come back to that. Verse 5, so he invited each person who owed money to his employer to come and to discuss the situation. Now, if you've ever owed money, you borrowed money. By the way, I want to say this real quick. This money that people owe his employer, they're not like people down the street who fell on hard times and borrowed 20 bucks, promised to pay it back. That's not the kind of people who owe him money. The people who owe this man money are business people. They're people who they're borrowing money for their opportunities. This rich man's lending out money. This money manager's handling his money by investing it for him, like you might do, and maybe diversify through the stock exchange, right, or some ETFs. Or real estate or other things. In this particular case, the man seems to be a bit of a venture capitalist or an angel investor, and he invests in other people's businesses. And they owe him money. When you invest in people's businesses like that, and they borrow from you to build their business, they might either pay you back in a certain period of time what they've borrowed plus a certain extra percentage to make it worth your while. Or perhaps you get a percentage of the company. Or maybe they get a loan and they make monthly payments at a certain interest rate and they can pay it off faster or not. It could go a number of different ways, but I'll tell you one thing. When you're rich, and if you know this, when you're rich, you have more opportunities for better investment opportunities than the average plebe does, you know. A little safer hold and better returns, and there's enough money there that I can put it some places. And this man's lending out money and getting a good return on his investment because he's rich. And the money manager's handling all of these affairs for this rich man. So the money manager says, I'm about to get fired. I got to make some friends. What am I going to do? He calls in all the people who owe his man money that they borrowed to do their work. Now, you know, if you've ever owed money to somebody or borrowed money from any institution, you hope it's a good relationship. They lent it, you're paying it back, everyone's happy. If you fall behind, it's kind of ugh. If you're paying your payments, but they call you and say, hey, we want to meet together about your loan, you're like, oh no, are they changing the terms? Can they even do that? Are they calling my loan? What's going to happen? I'm sure that these people arrived with a knot in their own stomach now. What does he want? Because this is the man who manages the money. He's the one who gives them the money, signs the contracts, who collects it. The rich man doesn't do anything. He's just living a good life. This is the man. And they come in wondering why he wants to see them. It says in verse 5, part B, he says, he asked the first one, how much do you owe him? How much do you owe my employer? The man replied, I owe him 800 gallons of olive oil. Again, another way to know he's not lending someone down the street a small loan. You don't usually go to your neighbor and say, hey, I need to borrow a little olive oil, maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3 cups or 800 gallons. So this is a pretty big loan for a pretty big business move. And the guy said, I owe him 800. Now, has he owed him for a long time? Has he been paying it back? I don't know, but I owe 800 gallons of olive oil. Verse 6, the manager told him, take the bill and quickly change it to 400 gallons. Write 400 gallons down, and basically I'll sign off on that. That was his authority. He's not doing anything illegal. It's his job as money manager to, it might be foolish, it might be not preferred, but he has the authority to do that. And he says, change it to 400, I'll sign off on it right now. He cuts the man's bill in half. In half. Pretty happy man there, I'd say. Okay, thank you so much. You're welcome. Remember me. Verse 7, he says, and how much do you owe my employer? He asked the next man. Well, I owe him 1,000 bushels of wheat, was the reply. Here, the manager said, take the bill and change it to 800 bushels, a 20% reduction. That's not bad. Now, I want to quickly say this. I doubt the rich man is probably losing money in this story. First of all, he's rich. That makes it okay that he's rich and you can't rob from him. But he's well off. But probably these loans were built in such a way, like you build with margin. Take 20% off of what you owe me, I'll still make a little money. Not as much as I wanted to make, but I'm probably going to come out okay. Now, the 50% cut's a bit deeper. Maybe that guy owed a long time and made lots of payments, and over time, he's made his money. He's not, I don't know. I'm assuming the manager's not making him lose money, but he's cutting a lot of profits that the rich man hired him to earn for him, and he's cutting them way down. And he's not in there for charity or to break even. He's there to make money. Not a criminal offense because he's got the authority to do it until he gets fired, but not he's not doing right by his employer because it's his money. He's doing right by himself with the authority he has until he doesn't have the authority anymore. Because why? He's probably thinking, these people are going to love me for this. What's the boss going to do? Fire me? He's going to fire me anyhow. What's the harm? Going to double fire me? I'll be okay. So he knows he's out anyhow, so he just does some things within his authority to get himself some friends. Verse number 8 says, the rich man had to admire the dishonest rascal for being so shrewd. It does not say the rich man liked it. Oh, good. I lost all sorts of money I would have gotten. I'm happy. No, he doesn't like it. He's firing the guy for sure now, you know. But he's like, got to hand it to him. Got to hand it to him. He figured out how to, on his way out the door, he figured out how to better his situation. How to build some network, some people. Give him credit for that. He was shrewd. And now Jesus is about to make a statement that's interesting to me. He's not going to give us the point of the story yet. That comes in a little later. Instead, he's going to make almost a side note, a side observation, which makes me feel better as a communicator whenever I take a rabbit trail. Because apparently Jesus decides to take a little side note in his story on his way to his conclusion here. And here's what Jesus says. He says, and it is true that the children of this world are more shrewd in dealing with the world around them than are the children of the light. He's just making an observation. The children of the light would be people who've come to the understanding of God and faith and things of that nature. Children of the light. Someone who's understood the goodness of God, the grace of God, the love of God. As Jesus made the gospel clear through his death and resurrection today, we'd say those who've received the gospel of Jesus Christ, they've been enlightened to faith. And Jesus says those kind of people are often not as good at being the word shrewd. He uses the word shrewd. They're not as shrewd in their dealings in this world sometimes as people who are not spiritually enlightened or people of faith. Sometimes people of this world who haven't figured that out yet are smarter in dealing with the world, dealing with business, dealing with money, dealing with networking, dealing with relationships than people who are children of the light. He's making an observation. He's not saying this is a good thing. He's not saying this is how it's supposed to be. He's not applauding it. He's just observing it. And by the way, isn't that a true observation that many of us have made if you've been around long enough? There's a lot of people who are religiously aware and come to the knowledge of God, but not really is that sharp on other things. And others are really good in this things in this world. And you might think, well, they must be right because they've been enlightened with faith, but they're not very good at the other stuff. And other people who are very smart in this world and get ahead and sharp, and you're like, man, they're impressive, but they don't know the Lord. And Jesus is making an observation that sometimes they don't have to be contrary. It doesn't have to be one or the other. It just sometimes is. Some people are both. Some people are neither. But he's just noticing a discrepancy here. And so because Jesus made the side observation, I'm going to take the liberty to go a little deeper in it myself before we move on and make a statement that this verse reminds me of that we've made before, but let me make it again. That being right with Jesus doesn't make you right about everything else. I think we need to remember that. Because some of them, what do you mean? I'm right about everything. Being right about Jesus So Jesus was saying, some of the children of the light aren't sure about, got other things figured out very well. The folks who got other things don't have God figured out. And we can be right about Jesus and not right about other things. And we need to remember that. And I'll tell you why. Because humans, we're really good at thinking we're right. And that's normal. People are like, you just think you're right all the time. Well, of course we do. If I thought I was wrong, if you thought you were wrong, we would change and be right. So of course we think we're right. That's a silly thing. But here's the difference. Some people think they're right, but they're open-handed. They're humble about it. They're like, I think I'm right, but I could be wrong. And I am willing to consider other possibilities. And I'm willing to change my mind. And there are people who say, well, that's me. I would be glad if you could prove it to me, I'd be glad to change my mind. That's usually, some people say that when what they mean is, no one's ever proved it to me, though I happen to always be right. Okay, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about truly humble people who say, there's probably things that I'm wrong about. And when confronted with better information, I will pivot. And I'm not saying that as an excuse to double down. I'm saying I'm curious. People who are curious to explore the frontiers of their own ignorance. Instead of just saying, nope, I got it all figured out. And this is not a Christian thing. This is a human thing. You can be a person of faith or not of faith. You can have any belief system in the world and just say, I'm always right. But are you humble enough to consider that we could be wrong? Are you curious enough to learn what might challenge your beliefs? And then, are you gracious enough towards others that when they think something different than you, you're willing to say, could be. I think this is right, but you might have a point because I'm not always right. See what I'm saying? But this is a human thing, and here's the point I'm making right now. Here's the main point, is that sometimes, even though Christians aren't worse at this necessarily, the Christian problem is that some Christians say, because I'm right about Jesus, therefore I'm more right about everything else. And Jesus just said in no unequivocal terms, that's not always the case. But we get more arrogant about it. But we're not. And in fact, I remember the Apostle Paul once said in Corinthians, he says that, he made a verse that I've heard people misquote so many times where they'll say, well, the scripture says that the unregenerated person doesn't understand the things of God's spirit and cannot know them, for they're not spiritually discerned. So therefore, if I disagree with you, I'm right with God, so I'm right and you're wrong because I have discernment. Well, that's a nice blanket, arrogant statement. What's interesting is that there's denominations all over the Christian realm right now that all believe in Jesus and have Jesus figured out right, but they differ very strongly on church polity and style and how a denomination should look and how a church should run, how leadership should go, how we should teach and preach and everything. We have all sorts of opinions out there of people who all have Jesus right but don't have the other things in line. Someone's wrong. So it's obvious that someone can be right with Jesus and wrong about church. You can be right with Jesus and wrong about politics. Oh no, my faith informs my politics, brother. Everyone on all sides say that. Well, they're wrong, I'm right. Of course we are right. You can be right about Jesus and wrong about relationships. Well, God's spirit's in me, so they must be wrong because I'm always right. You ever know somebody who's very religious and they understand Jesus very well and you're thinking, oof, they're a pill to live with. So, Jesus is pointing out something that we need to keep it close to heart. He's saying, I've just noticed that sometimes the people in this world are more shrewd in how they handle things around them than children of the light. That doesn't mean they should be. It just happens to be a thing that's true today. And all of us who think that we have it all, no matter what we believe, but especially as Jesus followers, ought never to say, I must be right. We ought to say, I'm humble and I'm curious and I'm gracious with others because, there's bigger questions than just me being so sure of myself. That's just a side note that he made. I love it. But what's the point? What's the point of the parable? Is Jesus saying in this story that we should be like this dishonest manager? Is Jesus teaching you should just screw over your boss real good and make more money for yourself and ha, 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 get ahead, woo? Is that what he's saying? I don't think so. In fact, I know he's not saying that. What's his point in telling this story? He tells us his point in verse 9. Are you ready? Jesus says, here's the lesson. Use your worldly resources to benefit others and make friends. Pretty straightforward. This is my point. Use your, you say, well, the guy in the story didn't have his worldly resources. He had his bosses he used to benefit others and make friends. Yes, we're going to get to that in a minute here. But Jesus is not telling us about the boss now. He's taking the application. Remember when Jesus tells a parable, that he has a point in telling the parable, and if you get too hung up on the parable, you'll make applications that Jesus was not trying to make. You can go down some weird rabbit holes. For example, Jesus is not the rich man in the story who's like in heaven going, God's not in heaven saying, they're doing what with my stuff? I had no idea. That's not what's happening. It's just a parable to illustrate a point. And while this man misused his, he wasted his employer's stuff in the first place, which was getting him fired, and then he gave it away without his permission, Jesus is saying, for you, I want you to learn the lesson of the generosity that benefited this man, and you do the same thing. Use your worldly resources to benefit others. Use your worldly resources to make friends. And then he adds this statement. He says in the next part of the verse, then when your possessions are gone, they will welcome you to an eternal home. Now this gets a little fuzzy. People raise their eyebrow. What does that mean? What does it mean that if we do that, then when our possessions are gone, they will welcome us to an eternal home? If that confuses you or gives you any pause, I want to congratulate you for being normal. Because people have argued about the theology of the last part of that verse forever. I've been doing this for a long time. This has always been a debatable application in the last half of this verse. What does that mean? What does that mean? What does that mean? In fact, I've always known there's usually several different schools of thought on what it means. And just because I wanted to, the last couple of weeks, get ready for this sermon, I went down that rabbit hole again. It's been a while. And I got myself in a forum, for example, where a bunch of theologians and, you know, Christian teachers were debating what that means. Then when your possessions are gone, they will welcome you to eternal home. And there was a lot of different theories, and they all sounded good. People would put a theory together. Well, the Greek word here says this, and then this verse elsewhere says Joyce supports this and this. And I'd be like, wow, that's really convincing. And then the comments, they would poke holes all through their idea. Like, oh, never mind. And then that person would give their thought, and it sounds good, and they'd poke holes in that. And when I'd all said it, I counted about five decent theories, but really two. Most everyone, you could coalesce in the end around two big ideas. And there's more. If you want to be nerdy, that's your kind of jam, talk to me after church, and we can talk about it. But here's the big ideas. There's the big two most common takeaways of what this means, that when your possessions are gone, they'll welcome you into eternal home. Some people, two big ideas, some people believe it means the afterlife, that when your possessions are gone means when your life is over. They'll be there because you've been generous to others to welcome you into your eternal home, which doesn't mean work salvation. It means they're here, you know, they saved you. It means they're welcoming you. Thank you for giving to the Lord, you know. But you say, is that true? It's supported elsewhere in Scripture, where the rich man who comes to Jesus and says, what must I do to earn eternal life? And Jesus says, well, you can be perfect. Well, I am. Okay, then give everything you have away, sell it all, give it all to the poor, and come follow me. You'll have treasure in heaven. Similar vibe. Or, check this out, we're in Luke 16 right now. Same chapter, later on, there's a story coming up in an upcoming week. Wait for it, it's going to be fun, or not. It's going to be good. Of another rich man who had a poor man living next to him who neglected him his whole life and never takes care of the poor man who's desperate, and they both die, and the rich man then wakes up in the bad place, and the poor man wakes up in the good place, and the rich man's not the one begging. And that's a whole other story we're going to get to soon in the same chapter. So it could very well be the principle of saying, yeah, do what God has given you to make friends and help other people, and then when your time is up, those people will be there to welcome you and say, hey, into your eternal home. That might be the application. The other school of thought, and I love this one, is that it's not referring to eternity the way we often think of eternity, the way sometimes the word is used. It's referring to like an everlasting, sometimes is another word used, enduring. Like when you lose your stuff and the bottom falls out for you, people will help you who his stuff endured. Best way I can explain is I heard someone one time say, hey, we just moved into our forever home. We just bought and moved into our forever home. Now, what does that mean? That means that they're never going to die now. They're going to live there forever and ever and ever and ever and ever in that home? I don't think so. Does that mean that they're going to, no one else will ever buy it once they die? They're just going to haunt it forever? Like Beetlejuice or something? I don't know. What does that mean, my forever home? What they mean is this is the last home we'll ever have to buy. This is it. This is our place. Like buying a tool that's supposed to have a lifetime warranty. This is an everlasting hammer. You can't break. No, it's just the last one you'll ever have to buy, you know. So the application there becomes people saying that when your possessions are gone, when you hit spots in life where you lose it all, where things just happen, folks, right? And you're in a pickle, that if you've used your resources to be good to others, the people will be there to be good for you when their bottom hasn't dropped out and they have things that are lasting. They'll take care of you when you're in trouble, which is also a biblical idea. Elsewhere in the Bible, it says what? Give, and it will be given unto you. Pressed down, shaken together, and running over will people add to you. That's a biblical idea. So which is it? Which of these big ideas does this last part of the verse mean? Could it be both? Jesus once said to his disciples, there's no one who has ever followed me that doesn't get blessed both in this life and the life to come. So there's that theory. We'll see that story soon as well. So what does it mean? And my answer is, I don't think it's that important. It is important. But if people who are really smart can debate it, here's the question. What's clear? What is not debatable? What is crystal clear in this verse? Someone be brave and tell me. Well, here's somebody. There you go. The first part. Use your worldly resources to benefit others and make friends. That's clear. There's no debate about that. You know, I've learned a lot of times people like to argue about the promises of God. And what they mean, what they don't mean, and get these big religious debates about things. And we forget to do the part that God told us we're supposed to do. Can I give a bigger rabbit trail than I gave the last crowd? You're going to get extra something here. I remember the first time I realized people do this in church world when I was much younger, and I saw people debating over an ancient proverb, Proverbs 22:6, where it says, train up a child in the way they should go, and when they are old, they will not depart from it. People would debate what that means, when they're old, they will not depart from it. Debate what it means. And people would be like, that verse doesn't work because I train up my children well, and they departed from it when they were older. And others would be like, well, you must not have because the verse says this, so you must not have, you know, judge others, whatever. People say, it's a premise or a promise, which is the difference? And all these silly arguments that I could talk about all day long, and we had that conversation for a whole Sunday. But I've always said that wasn't the point. We can wonder what the promise looks like, but here's what the verse was saying. Raise your kids the best you can, the right way. That's what we control. The other part, there's everyone's better. Everything's better when you do that. And that's the same thing going on here. What does it mean? This, now, later, future? Here's what it means. Use your worldly resources to do good, benefit others, make friends. And then we can debate it. And there's nothing wrong with that. Some people like to nerd out. They like to debate all sorts of things that I get tired of debating in church world. I said this at the end of last service, but I'll say it now. I can be very nerdy, as much as anybody, when getting into these weeds and arguing eschatology or things. I don't enjoy it like I used to. Nothing wrong with it. It's no worse of a time spent than playing golf or video games, I think. But we argue about things that people who are smart can't figure out and agree on sometimes. And I'll be honest, it gets wearisome to me. What is hell? What is heaven? What is the end times? The end times this, and that's going to... Yeah, sure. It's fun. I have theories. I have verses. I read. I have comments. But to really get and battle this out and make this my mission in life, I just get a little more practical at some point. Like, what are we supposed to do? Jesus says, here's what you're supposed to do. Use your worldly... So here's what I did. I took this verse on the screen, and I decided to paraphrase it. I'm not rewriting the Bible. I'm not making a new translation. I'm just paraphrasing what Jesus said to hit the practical points for us. And it goes like this. Jesus is saying, use your resources to benefit others, and you'll find a benefit too. Well, when? In this life? Sure. In the next life? Sure. In both? Sure. But he promises it'll benefit you too, and we can wrestle that all we want to, but here's the promise. Do that. Our challenge is clear. Use our resources to benefit others and make friends. Now, in case anyone's saying, well, hold on, Arlen, I thought the point of the story was be dishonest and take advantage of your boss's money when he's not looking. Jesus is going to address that in the next couple of verses. Are you ready? Verse 10. Jesus says, if you are faithful in little things, you will be faithful in larger ones, in large ones. But if you are dishonest in little things, you won't be honest with greater responsibility. So Jesus is right now making very clear that he is not advocating for dishonesty. This verse is plain. Don't be dishonest is what he's saying. But he's saying if you're dishonest in the little things, what's the little things? He doesn't say. He just mentioned if you're dishonest with little things, who's going to entrust you with greater responsibilities? If you're not faithful with little things, what's the little things? Doesn't say. But you're faithful with the large things. Well, Arlen, I want to know what's the little things and what's the larger things. Well, he tells us in the next verse. Are you ready? Let's keep reading. Verse number 11. And if you are untrustworthy about worldly wealth, a.k.a. the little things. Are you with me? Are you following? If you aren't trustworthy about worldly wealth, which is in his own parallel, that means those are the little things. If you aren't trustworthy about worldly wealth, who will trust you with the true riches of heaven? It's crystal clear. Now, the worldly wealth is the little things, but Jesus is coming back to his earlier side observation, and he's driving it home. Because we're saying, that's right. I'm right about Jesus. I'm a child of the light. So I might not be as shrewd about the things of this world as other people are, but that's okay because I'm a child of the light and that's the bigger stuff. No, no, no. What Jesus is saying is if you've come to the knowledge of Jesus Christ in faith, that's awesome. But how we handle these other things, these, what we might say are little things, is what God entrusts us with, the bigger things. Don't be enlightened spiritually and careless practically. Don't be so heavenly minded that you're not very earthly savvy. He's saying, well, God gives you things, be faithful with what he gives you. He's calling us out on his earlier observation. He says it's time that some of the children of the light figured out how to handle their business, how to manage their money, how to network with people, how to make some friends, how to get ahead. It's time some of us figured this out here. Because it shows that we're faithful with these things, and God blesses that. And then he makes this observation in verse 12. And if you are not faithful with other people's things, why should you be entrusted with things of your own? And you're like, Arlen, that doesn't apply to me, because I don't manage other people's things. The manager in the story managed the rich man's things, but Arlen, I am not a money manager. And I want to challenge you that you are indeed a manager. Because everything that you and I have has come from God and is entrusted to us. We are all, the old church word was stewards. We are all stewards, managers of what God has entrusted to us. So no, I built this and I'm a self-made person. No, we're not. Everything we have has come from God. Think about this. We woke up this morning because God let us have another day. Some people were not so fortunate. Some of us didn't want to wake up this morning. You got out of bed. Some of us didn't want to get out of bed this morning. You got out of bed, maybe painstakingly, but you functioned and got ready because God gave us the ability. Some people don't have that ability anymore. God gave us the motor skills to come and think and drive and listen and learn and speak and grow because God has allowed us that. Some people have lost that or don't have that. You have the gifts and talents because God has given them to you. I'm not diminishing your part. Be very clear. I'm not diminishing our part. To take what God gives us and to build with it and be responsible with it, awesome. That's the whole point of the story. Be faithful with what God gives you and make better of it. Take the gifts God gives you and excel with them. Grow. That's awesome. That's our part. But we understand that we wouldn't have the skills, the life, the gifts, the talents, or the opportunities to do what we do and be faithful with what we do had God not given it to us in the first place. We are managers of the things that God allows us to have. We're not better than people who were born poorer. We're not better than people who were born with less. We're people born less healthy. We've been entrusted with more by God. And it's awesome that we're faithful with it. We should be. But we are managing what God has entrusted to us. And all of us in this room know very well it could go away that fast. That fast. Jesus says, you be faithful with what I've entrusted with you. The man of the story was not. He wasted his employer's stuff, which was getting him fired. Then he was generous for his own good without the employer's blessing. Jesus is saying, don't waste what God has given you, but God wants you to be generous with what he's given you to other people. So go be generous and build, benefit others. And you are a steward of what God has given you. But the reason we struggle with that, if we can be honest, is because we get, well, if I could be really blunt, we get greedy. So I'm not greedy. You know, Jesus speaks an awful lot about greed in the Bible. A lot about greed. In fact, he talks about it so much, we even gave a definition at church here a few times for greed. I want to give it to you again. Ready? Greed is the assumption that it's all for my consumption. That if it comes my way, it's for me. That's what greed is. If I'm benefited, it's because I'm awesome and God loves me. If you're in trouble and need help, well, you should have thought of that before you were born as a peasant, you know. But hey, I'm all good because God has blessed me. And greed can look two different ways. Greed can be saving my money so I have a lot in the bank and more in my investment portfolio until I hit a certain goal of a number. And then, of course, oftentimes that goal shifts and we move the goalpost because there's a higher level we come across. We're Ebenezer Scrooge, right? Just got to get all my money and count my bills, swim in my vault full of coins, like Scrooge McDuck, to quote another famous saint. Or there's another kind of greed. It's a little more ominous. Like, I don't save. No, we just spend. Whatever comes to us, we spend it. Comes to me, I spend it. It's on me. It's always for my, I want stuff, fancier this. Maybe I might go into debt to get more stuff because I want stuff and I want to enjoy it and I don't have any margin to help anybody else because I'm going to get more stuff. Whether we're spenders or savers, if we assume that everything that comes to me is for me to consume, that's greed. The assumption that it's all for my consumption. And Jesus is saying, I've given you everything you have. Be a good manager of that and benefit others, as he said earlier. Use it to make friends. Use it to do some good in this world. That's what I want you to do. God has bigger plans for us than to just be obsessed with what we can get for ourselves. But we know, don't we know, the difficulty is that money and material things have a way of getting our focus off of God and onto us. Paul would later write that love of money is the root of all types of evil. And some desire it so much they err from the faith, they do wrong things, and they pierce their lives with many sorrows. So Jesus closes this part of the story with one more statement. And it's a statement he's made before. In fact, it's a statement that he taught in the famous Sermon on the Mount. And he gives it again right now. He says in verse 13, no one can serve two masters. For you will hate one and love the other. You'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and be enslaved to money. You can't have two masters. They're both going to vie for who are you really loyal to. And when you choose to go the one way, the other one's going to feel hated and the other one's going to feel loved. There's going to be a conflict of interest and you can't serve both. As a side note, nothing to do with today's sermon, but as a side note, there's one reason why I think polygamy is wrong. A man should only have one wife. Why? Because no man can serve two masters. So you should only be... That joke, sorry. But no, here's the thing. He's saying you can't serve two masters. You just can't. You cannot serve God and be enslaved to money. That money makes a wonderful servant, but a terrible master. And what happens is if you're not careful, at some point God's going to ask something of us that's going to cost us some possessions or money or something. Or our desire for more possessions and money and stuff is going to cause us to say, God, back burner with you. Back burner with you, God. And that's the tug. Who do we serve? And what serves us? And greed creeps in and says, but that's what it's there for. It's there for me. And so I want to close today with a practical. I told you earlier, I the older I get, and I've been around doing ministry most of my life, all my adult life, the longer I get, the more I don't care about the debates that cause good Jesus-believing people to have differences of opinions and not talk to each other. I just get tired of a lot of that stuff. I just want to know what God wants. I want to get really practical. And so I always try to leave you not just with a teaching. Like, I hope you learned something today. I hope that story was either new to you or you went deeper than you've gone before. And you're like, okay, that will stick with me. I want us to do more than learn something. I want us to do something. What's the application? So I try to always give an action step. And today's action step, I'm just going to give you what Jesus gave us earlier that I paraphrased, because he gave the best action step today. And that is this. As you go home, use your resources to benefit others, and you'll find a benefit too. When, Arlen? Next week? Yeah, maybe. Next year? Sure. Next decade? Possibly. Next life? Sure. God promises he'll benefit you. He'll bless you when you use what he's given you to benefit others, and not just ourselves, that's greed, to benefit others and make friends. We have a chance to do some good in this world, to leverage what God has given us to bless others, to show people his love through our generosity. By the way, I mentioned greed earlier. You know that generosity is the tool that breaks greed? It's generosity. When we use what God's given us to be generous to others, it shows them that God is good through us, and we can point them to his love and his light, which is the whole point in the first place. So let's decide to use our resources to benefit others, to make friends, and we will find a benefit as well.